Hello everyone, welcome to episode 7 of our Vested Finance podcast. My name is Kaihan Lin. I'm an editor at Vested calling in from Singapore. I'm your co-host for today's session. My co-host today is Darwin Arifin, a co-founder at Vested who is recording from the US. Welcome, Darwin.
Thanks, Kai. Glad to be here again. And to our listeners, thanks for joining us this week. All right, Kai, what are we discussing today?
We're going to talk about Tesla and Netflix. But first, the topics discussed and the opinions expressed in this podcast are purely for your information purposes and represent only the opinions of the individuals and not Vested Finance. Furthermore, the material in this podcast is not intended to be investment advice and should not be relied upon to make any investment decisions. You should consult with your own financial advisor before making any investment decisions. All right then, the earnings season for some of the largest companies in the US has begun. Tesla just announced theirs last week. How did they do?
Well, Tesla reported its strongest quarter ever. The company generated $7.6 billion, which is a 39% revenue growth year over year. So that's awesome. Beyond this top line number, though, two of Tesla's most important metrics for investors are car deliveries, which is the primary way it makes money, and operating cash flow, which is needed to continue to fund operations, factory builds out, and inventory, because on average, globally, Tesla holds about 20 or so days of global inventory. That's money tied up in cars sitting in lots and factories. So this past quarter, Tesla delivered 139,593 cars, which is also a record. Overall, however, Tesla is targeting to ship out 500,000 cars in 2020. And to achieve this, Tesla needs to deliver more than 180,000 cars in Q4, more than the record Q3 that it just reported. So that's quite a tall order. And on the cash flow front, Tesla generated $1.4 billion from its operations this past quarter. And now that it's maintaining profitability, the company has good cash balance position, totaling about $14.5 billion.
So earlier this year, Tesla opened their Shanghai factory, and now they're reducing the price of their base Model 3. Coupled with the Chinese government's provision for subsidies for electric vehicle ownership, could this move help Tesla with profitability?
So the company seems to be gaining efficiency in China. The reason they reduced their selling price, Model 3, they just reduced the selling price by about 19% or so to 250,000 RMB after incentives. So this is about $37,300. Tesla did this so that they can qualify for a new government subsidy that requires the price below a certain threshold. So this price, Model 3, in China now undercuts other premium sedans like the Mercedes C-Class, the BMW 3 Series, and the Audi A4. China is interesting because Tesla actually received a lot of subsidies from the Chinese government to build the factory. It received special treatment and provisions to keep the factory going even under COVID lockdowns. Combined with lower wage, material costs, and government subsidies, the factory in Shanghai is probably the cheapest to make cars in for Tesla. Right now, though, more than 70% of cars made in each region are sold in that region. So this means that cars made in the US are sold in the US, and cars made in China are sold in China. And I think we can expect moving forward that Tesla will lower that percentage. It makes more sense for the company to export cars made in cheaper regions such as China elsewhere to Europe or the US. And Tesla has already announced that they plan to export Shanghai-made cars to Europe. There are two key implications to this. Number one, this will help Tesla become more profitable. You're already seeing this effect. The GAAP margin this past quarter is about 23.5%, which is 4.6% higher than the same period last year. And number two, mostly from the Chinese government perspective, this helps China export more cars. We all know China is the factory of the world, but this is not true for car manufacturing. Most vehicles manufactured in China are sold within China. Manufactured vehicles for export is only 4% of the overall automobile production volume in China in 2019. So China wants to change this. It wants to make that mix larger and export more Chinese-made cars. In recent years, the country has made policy changes to make it even easier for foreign car makers to use China as the global manufacturing hub for cars. But specifically around electric vehicles, recently Foxconn, you know them as the largest contract manufacturing company in the world. They make all the iPhones. They pretty much make all the phones, the smartphones, a lot of LCDs. But they also plan to build their own electric vehicle platform. So these things look like a skateboard, a big base, a rectangular base with batteries and chassis with four wheels at the end and a motor. So now, if you want to start an electric car company or produce electric cars from your existing model, all you have to do is pick and choose from different options and slap your own brand on top of Foxconn's manufactured and designed cars. So I think in 5 years, the landscape of electric vehicles will be very different than it is today. There will be a lot more brands out there.
So what about Tesla's hope to be included in the S&P 500?
It's still alive. Tesla meets the profitability criteria, so the hope is still there. It depends now on the S&P 500 committee, and they actually have control to add any companies to the index anytime.
All right, shifting gears to Netflix. Netflix also announced their earnings last week, and it reported slower than expected growth. Now, I expected Q3 to be better considering the relentless onslaught of COVID. Should investors be worried?
I think it's not that big of a surprise that the growth in this most recent quarter, the second half of 2020, has slowed down. The company has pretty much told investors that that would be the case after an extremely strong growth in the beginning of the year. After all, if a global pandemic and a lockdown does not push you to sign up for Netflix, not much will, right? And that is exactly what happened. Nonetheless, investors were disappointed with the latest subscriber growth number, which resulted in a drop in the share price. So when we wrote our blog, the share price has dropped more than 7% since the earnings release. It's unlikely to be a big deal in the long term, though. If you look at Netflix quarterly subscriber growth from the past 19 quarters, the company has missed 5 out of 19 and beating the remaining 14. Overall, the management has done a good job in predicting growth. That or it's been throwing itself softballs. So in the meantime, over that same period, 19 quarters, the share price has quadrupled.
I think what's interesting is not just the acceleration of subscriber growth early in the year due to the lockdown, but more so that Netflix blew away its margins target.
Yeah, that's right. Netflix initially targeted 16% operating margins for 2020, and they've raised that forecast to 18% now. Operating margin is a very important number when thinking about Netflix. In 2016, Netflix operating margin is about 4%. So since then, it has quadrupled its margins. And that's an incredible accomplishment. Typically, as companies grow bigger and as the market matures, you have cost pressure from both sides of the equations. If you think about, especially on the streaming business, you have pressure on the content supply and on the demand side. For a company like Netflix, for example, the cost to buy content should go up. Right now, it's competing with Amazon Prime, NBC, and HBO streaming services. And then the cost of advertising should also goes up. So the cost of acquiring customer goes up because the market becomes more saturated. If these two happens, then operating margin typically goes down. But this is not true for Netflix because it has the benefit of scale. We've dissected Netflix strategy in our previous blog post, which we will link in the show notes. But at a high level, Netflix moat is that it has the largest global subscriber base. Right now, it has about 195 million subscribers. So when Netflix spends $11 billion on content, which it plans to do this year, just as a tangent, $11 billion is what it would cost Intel to build a new semiconductor factory. So $11 billion is a lot of money. But when Netflix spends $11 billion on content, they have the luxury to spread that fixed spending to 195 million subscribers, or of order of $56 per subscriber in 2020. You contrast this to, say, a newer player, say HBO, which has about 38 million global subscribers. If HBO spends the same as Netflix, about $11 billion, they end up spending close to $300 per subscriber, about 5 times higher. But this is why it's very difficult for smaller competitors to compete against Netflix's scale advantage.
Almost half of Netflix's new subscribers came from Asia Pacific, driven by the company's investment into providing local content in other countries. I myself returned to the Netflix scene this year because of the increase in the Southeast Asian content. Has this strategy paid off?
Yeah, it seems so. Nearly half of new subscribers this past quarter came from the APAC, Asia Pacific region. As a result, the APAC revenue went up 66% year over year. And this growth was largely driven by increased penetration in 2 countries, South Korea and Japan, which are up to double-digit penetration for broadband homes. Undoubtedly, this is probably thanks to the company's investments in local content, especially Korean drama and Japanese anime. And luckily, these two types of contents travel well outside their home countries and are cheaper to make. The management letter also mentioned they've only achieved double-digit penetration for broadband homes. So it's still early days. When you think about just cross double-digit penetrations, implies they just crossed 10% or so. In contrast, Netflix has more than 50% penetration in broadband homes in the US. There's a lot more room for Netflix to grow in Asia Pacific and also internationally.
Now on to the third topic of today's podcast. You talked about the most profitable companies on your blog, where oftentimes it's best to sell jeans and pickaxes when in the midst of a gold rush. Can you expand on this?
Yeah, I was reading this great book. It's titled Dark Pools by Scott Patterson. It's about the history of high frequency trading, the genesis of AI trading, and dark pools in the stock exchanges, which prompted me to learn more about how these stock exchanges make money. And I was surprised at how profitable some of these companies are. Typically, in a bubble or in a gold rush, right, the enduring wealth is generated when you're selling the tool. Take the California gold rush, for example. Hundreds of thousands of people came from all over the world to settle in California to mine for gold. San Francisco grew from a small settlement of roughly 200 people in 1846 to a booming town of 36,000 in 1852. Most of these miners did not generate enduring wealth. After the surface gold was extracted, mining was really difficult and dangerous work. From this rush, the people who profited the most were sellers of goods and equipment, and one among them was Levi Strauss. He was a Bavarian immigrant who sold equipment and durable clothes made of tent canvas to miners. His company still endures today as Levi Strauss and Company. They make laser-induced fetus jeans. If you want to see the GIF of one of these, you should check out the articles on our website. But the same thing happened in the recent crypto bubble. A lot of value was captured by Nvidia and TSMC as the purveyor of GPU and ASIC chips to mine crypto. So that was a tangent, but with increasing penetration of equity investing globally, some of these companies that capture the most values are the owners of the exchanges. They make money from trading, clearing, selling data, and they are some of the most profitable companies in the world. If you look at the net income margins of these companies, some of them are even more profitable than the largest internet giants of the world, Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Netflix, Google, and Microsoft, which are highly profitable internet giants, right? So the two that are most profitable are Intercontinental Exchange, ICE, owner of the New York Stock Exchange, and the CME Group.
Well then, that's it for today's session. Thank you very much for your insights, Darwin.
As always, man, my pleasure.
To our listeners, thank you for tuning in. We hope you've enjoyed listening to this episode. For more insights into markets and emerging technologies, please visit our blog at blog.vested.co.in. As always, take care and stay safe.